From the studios of Books in Motion, this is Cameron Byerly reading Demon Lord of Karanda, Book 3 of The Malorian by David Eddings. We begin with the prologue. Being a brief history of Meloria and the races that dwell there, digested from the Chronicles of Angarak, University of Melsine Press. Tradition places the ancestral home of the Angaraks somewhere off of the south coast of present-day Dalesia. Then Torak, dragon god of Angarak, used the power of the stone, Thragyaska, in what has come to be called the cracking of the world. The crust of the earth split, releasing liquid magma from below and letting the waters of the southern ocean in to form the Sea of the East. This cataclysmic process continued for decades before the world gradually assumed its present form. As a result of this upheaval, the Aelorns and their allies were forced to retreat into the unexplored reaches of the western continent, while the Angaraks fled into the wilderness of Meloria. Torak had been maimed and disfigured by the stone, which rebelled at the use to which the god put it, and the Grolem priests were demoralized. Thus, leadership fell by default to the military. By the time the Grolems recovered, the military had established de facto rule of all of Angarak. Lacking their former preeminence, the priests set up an opposing center of power at Malyaska, near the tip of the Kerendiz mountain range. At this point, Torak roused himself to prevent the imminent civil war between priesthood and military rule. But he made no move against the military headquarters at Malzeth. Instead, he marched to the extreme northwest of Meloria Antiqua, with a quarter of the Angarak people to build the holy city of Xthol Mishrak. There he remained, so absorbed by efforts to gain control of Thragyaska, that he was oblivious to the fact that the people had largely turned from their previous preoccupation with theological matters. Those with him in Xthol Mishrak were mostly a hysterical fringe of fanatics under the rigid control of Torak's three disciples, Zadar, Tuchik, and Irvon. These three maintained the old forms in the society of Xthol Mishrak, while the rest of Angarak changed. When the continuing friction between the church and military finally came to Torak's attention, he summoned the military high command and the Grolem hierarchy to Xthol Mishrak and delivered his commands in terms that brooked no demur. Exempting only Malyaska and Malzeth, all towns and districts were to be ruled jointly by the military and priesthood. The subdued hierarchy and high command immediately settled their differences and returned to their separate enclaves. This enforced truce freed the generals to turn their attention to other peoples living in Meloria. The origin of these peoples are lost in myth, but three races had predated the Angaraks on the continent: the Dalesians of the southwest, the Karens of the north, and the Melsines of the east. It was to the Karens the military turned its efforts. The Karens were a warlike race with little patience for cultural niceties. They lived in crude cities where hogs roamed freely in the muddy streets. Traditionally, they were related to the Morindum of the far north of Garognadrak. Both races were given to the practice of demon worship. At the beginning of the second millennium, roving bands of Kerendiz brigands had become a serious problem along the eastern frontier, and the Angarak army now moved out of Melzeth to the western fringes of the Kerendiz kingdom of Palia. The city of Rakand in southwestern Palia was sacked and burned, and the inhabitants were taken captives. At this point, one of the greatest decisions of Angarak history was made. While the Grolems prepared for an orgy of human sacrifice, the generals paused. They had no desire to occupy Palia, and the difficulties of long-distance communication made the notion unattractive. To the generals, it seemed far better to keep Palia as a subject kingdom and exact tribute, rather than to occupy a depopulated territory. The Grolems were outraged, but the generals were adamant. Ultimately, both sides agreed to take the matter before Torak for his decision. Not surprisingly, Torak agreed with the high command. If the Karens could be converted, he would nearly double the congregation of his church, as well as the size of his army, for any future confrontations with the kings of the West.
Any man who liveth in boundless Meloria shall bow down and worship me, he told his reluctant missionaries.
And to ensure their zeal, he sent Irvan to Malyaska to oversee the conversion of the Kerans. There, Irvan established himself as temporal head of the Malorian church in pomp and luxury hitherto unknown to the ascetic Grolems. The army moved against Ketakor, Jeno, and Delshin, as well as Palya. But the missionaries fared poorly as the Kerandese magicians conjured up hordes of demons, calling upon them to defend their society. Irvan finally journeyed to Tol Mishrak to consult with Torak. It is not clear what Torak did, but the Kerandese magicians soon discovered that the spells previously used to control the demons were no longer effective. Any magician could now reach into the realm of darkness only at the peril of life and soul. The conquest of the Kerans absorbed the attention of both military and priesthood for the next several centuries. But ultimately, the resistance collapsed, and Karanda became a subject nation, its peoples generally looked upon as inferiors. When the army advanced down the great river Magan against the Melusine Empire, however, it met a sophisticated and technologically superior people. In several disastrous battles in which the Melusine war chariots and elephant cavalry destroyed whole battalions, the Angoraks abandoned their efforts. The Angorak generals made overtures of peace. To their astonishment, the Melusines quickly agreed to normalize relations and offered to trade horses, which the Angoraks previously lacked. They refused, however, even to discuss the sale of elephants. The army then turned to Delesia, which proved to be an easy conquest. The Delesians were simple farmers and herdsmen with little skill for war. The Angoraks moved into Delesia and established military protectorates during the next 10 years. The priesthood seemed at first equally successful. The Delesians meekly accepted the forms of Angorak worship. But they were a mystical people, and the Grolems soon discovered that the power of the witches, seers, and prophets remained unbroken. Moreover, copies of the infamous Malorian Gospels still circulated in secret among the Delesians. In time, the Grolems might have succeeded in stamping out the secret Delesian religion. But then, a disaster occurred that was to change forever the complexion of Angorak life. Somehow, the legendary sorcerer, Belgarath, accompanied by 3 Elorns, succeeded in evading all of the security measures and came unobserved at night to steal Thragyaske from the Iron Tower of Torak in the center of Tol Mishrak. Although pursued, they managed to escape with the stolen stone to the west. In furious rage, Torak destroyed his city. Then he ordered that the Murgos, the Tulls, and the Nadraks be sent to the western borders of the Sea of the East. More than 1 million lives were lost in the crossing of the northern land bridge, and the society and the culture of the Angoraks took long to recover. Following the dispersal and the destruction of Tol Mishrak, Torak became almost inaccessible, concentrating totally on various schemes to thwart the growing power of the kingdoms of the West. The gods' neglect gave the military time to exploit fully its now virtually total control of Meloria and the subject kingdoms. For many centuries, the uneasy peace between Angoraks and Melusines continued, broken occasionally only by little wars in which both sides avoided committing their full forces. The two nations eventually established the practice of each sending children of the leaders to be raised by leaders of the other side. This led to a fuller understanding by both, as well as to the growth of a body of cosmopolitan youths that eventually became the norm for the ruling class of the Malorian Empire. One such youth was Kalath, the son of a high-ranking Angorak general. Brought up in Melusine, he returned to Melzeth to become the youngest man ever to be elevated to the general staff. Returning to Melusine, he married the daughter of the Melusine emperor and managed to have himself declared emperor following the old man's death in 3830. Then, using the Melusine army as a threat, he managed to get himself declared hereditary commander-in-chief of the Angoraks. The integration of Melcine and Angerac was turbulent. But in time, the Melcine patients won out over Angerac brutality. Unlike other peoples, the Melcines were ruled by a bureaucracy, and in the end, that bureaucracy proved far more efficient than the Angerac military administration. By 4400, the ascendancy of the bureaucracy was complete. By that time, also, the title of commander-in-chief had been forgotten, and the ruler of both peoples was simply the Emperor of Meloria. To the sophisticated Melcines, the worship of Torak remained largely superficial. They accepted the forms out of expediency. But the Grolems were never able to command the abject submission to the dragon god that had characterized the Angeraks. Then, in 4850, Torak suddenly emerged from his aeons of seclusion to appear before the gates of Malzeth. Wearing a steel mask to conceal his maimed face, he set aside the emperor and declared himself Kal Torak, king and god. He immediately began mustering an enormous force to crush the kingdoms of the West and bring all the world under his domination. The mobilization that followed virtually stripped Meloria of able-bodied males. The Angeraks and Kerans were marched north to the land bridge, crossing to the northernmost Garag Nadrak, and the Dalesians and Melcines moved to where fleets had been constructed to ferry them across the Sea of the East to southern Tolmyrgos. The northern Melorians joined with the Nadraks, the Tulls, and the northern Murgos to strike toward the kingdoms of Thrasnia and Algeria. The second group of Melorians joined with southern Murgos and were to march northwesterly. Torak meant to crush the West between the two huge armies. These southern forces, however, were caught in a freak storm that swept in off of the Western Sea in the spring of 4875 that buried them alive in the worst blizzard of recorded history. When it finally abated, the column was mired in 14-foot snowdrifts that persisted until early summer. No theory has yet been able to explain this storm, which was clearly not of natural origin. Whatever the cause, the southern army perished. The few survivors who struggled back to the east told tales of horror that were truly unthinkable. The northern force was also beset by various disasters, but eventually laid siege to Vomimbre, where they were completely routed by the combined armies of the west. And there, Torak was struck down by the power of Tragyaska, there called the Orb of Aldur, and lay in a coma that was to last centuries, though his body was rescued and taken to a secret hiding place by his disciple Zadar. In the years following these catastrophes, Melorian society began to fracture back into its original components of Melcine, Karanda, Dalesia, and the lands of the Angeraks. The empire was saved only by the emergence of Korzeth as emperor. Korzeth was only 14 when he seized the throne from his aged father. Deceived by his youth, the separatist regions began to declare independence of the imperial throne. Korzeth moved decisively to stem the revolution. He spent the rest of his life on horseback in one of the greatest bloodbaths of history. But when he was done, he delivered a strong and united Meloria to his successors. Henceforth, the descendants of Korzeth ruled in total and unquestioned power from Malzeth. This continued until the present emperor, Zakath, ascended the throne. For a time, he gave promise of being an enlightened ruler of Meloria and the western kingdoms of the Angeraks. But soon, there were signs of trouble. The Murgos were ruled by Tar-Urgas, and it was evident that he was both mad and unscrupulously ambitious. He instigated some plot against the young emperor. It has never been established clearly what form his scheming took. But Zakath discovered that Tar-Urgas was behind it, and vowed vengeance. This took the form of a bitter war, in which Zakath began a campaign to destroy the mad ruler utterly. It was in the middle of this struggle that the West struck. While the kings of the West sent an army against the East, Belgarion, the young overlord of the West and descendant of Belgarath the Sorcerer, advanced on foot across the north and across the land bridge into Meloria. He was accompanied by Belgarath and a Drasnian, and he bore the ancient sword of Riva, on the pommel of which was Thragyaska, the orb of Aldur. His purpose was to slay Torak, apparently in response to some prophecy known in the West. Torak had been emerging from his long coma in the ruins of his ancient city of Tol Mishrak. Now he roused himself to meet the challenger. But in the confrontation, Belgarion overcame the god and slew him with the sword, leaving the priesthood of Meloria in chaos and confusion. Part 1 Chapter 1 The first snow of the season settled white and quiet through the breathless air onto the decks of their ship. It was a wet snow with large, heavy flakes that piled up on the lines and rigging, turning the tarred ropes into thick white cables. The sea was black. The swells rose and fell without sound. From the stern came the slow, measured beat of a muffled drum that set the stroke for the Melorian oarsmen. The sifting flakes settled on the shoulders of the sailors, and in the folds of their scarlet cloaks as they pulled steadily through the snowy morning. Their breath steamed in the chill dampness as they bent and straightened in unison to the beat of the drum. Geryon and Silk stood at the rail with their cloaks about their shoulders, staring somberly out through the filmy snowfall. "Miserable morning," the rat-faced little Drasnian noted, distastefully brushing snow from his shoulders. Geryon grunted sourly. "Oh, but you're in a cheerful humor today." "I don't really have all that much to smile about, Silk." Geryon went back to glowering at the gloomy black-and-white morning. Belgarath the sorcerer came out of the aft cabin, squinting up into the thickly settling snow, and raising the hood of his stout old cloak. Then he came forward, along the slippery deck, to join them at the rail. Silk glanced at the red-cloaked Melorian soldier who had, unobtrusively, came up onto deck behind the old man, and who now stood leaning with some show of idleness on the rail several yards aft. "I see that General Ateska is still concerned about your well-being," he said, pointing at the man who had dogged Belgarath's steps since they had sailed out of the harbor at Rakvakat. Belgarath threw a quick, disgusted glance in the soldier's direction. "Stupidity," he said shortly. "Where does he think I'm going?" A sudden thought came to Geryon. He leaned forward and spoke very quietly. "You know," he said, "we could go someplace at that. We have got a ship here, and a ship goes wherever you point it. Meloria, just as easily as the coast of Haga." "Oh, it's an interesting notion, Belgarath," Silk agreed. "There are four of us, Grandfather," Geryon pointed out. "You, me, Aunt Paul, and Durnik. I'm sure we wouldn't have much difficulty in taking over this ship. Then we could change course and be halfway to Meloria before Kalzakath realized that we were not coming to Rakhaga after all." The more he thought about it, the more the idea excited him. Then we could sail north along the Melorian coast, anchor in a cove or inlet someplace on the shore of Kamat. We'd only be a week or so from Asheba. We might even be able to get there before Zandramas does." A bleak smile touched his lips. "I would sort of like to be waiting for her when she gets there." "Oh, it's got definite possibilities, Belgarath," Silk said. "Could you do it?" Belgarath scratched thoughtfully at his beard, squinting out into the sifting snow. "It's possible," he admitted. He looked at Geryon. "But what do you think we ought to do with all of these Melorian soldiers and the ship's crew once we get to the coast of Kamat? You weren't planning to sink the ship and drown them all, were you, the way Zandramas does when she has finished using people?"
"Well, of course not."
"Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear that. But then how did you plan to keep them from running to the nearest garrison just as soon as we leave them behind? I don't know about you, but the idea of having a regiment or so of Melorian troops hot on our heels does not excite me all that much." Geryon frowned.
I guess I hadn't thought about that, he admitted. I didn't think you had. It's usually best to work your way completely through an idea before you put it into action. It avoids a great deal of spur-of-the-moment patching later on.
All right, Geryon said, feeling slightly embarrassed.
I know you're impatient, Geryon, but impatience is a poor substitute for a well-considered plan.
Do you mind, Grandfather? Geryon said acidly.
Besides, it might just be that we are supposed to go to Rakhaga and meet with Kalzikath. Why would Saradas turn us over to the Malorians after she went to all of the trouble of putting the Book of Ages into my hands? There is something else going on here, and I'm not sure we want to disrupt things until we find out a little more about them.
The cabin door opened, and General Ataska, the commander of the Malorian forces, occupying the Isle of Verkat, emerged. From the moment they had been turned over to him, Ataska had been polite and strictly correct in all of his dealings with them. He had also been very firm about his intention to deliver them personally to Kalzakath in Rakhaga. He was a tall, lean man, and his uniform was bright scarlet, adorned with numerous medals and decorations. He carried himself with erect dignity, though the fact that his nose had been broken at some time in the past made him look more like a street brawler than a general in an imperial army. He came up the slush-covered deck, heedless of his highly polished boots.
"Good morning, gentlemen," he greeted them with a stiff military bow. "I trust you slept well."
"Tolerably," Silk replied.
"It seems to be snowing," the general said, looking about and speaking in the tone of one making small talk for the sake of courtesy.
"Oh, I noticed that," Silk said.
"How long is it likely to take us to reach Rakhaga?"
"A few more hours to reach the coast, Your Highness, and then a two-day ride to the city."
Silk nodded.
"Have you any idea why your Emperor wants to see us?" he asked.
"He didn't say," Ataska answered shortly. "And I did not think it appropriate to ask. He merely told me to apprehend you and to bring you to him at Rakhaga. You are all to be treated with utmost courtesy as long as you do not try to escape. If you do that, His Imperial Majesty instructed me to be more firm."
His tone as he spoke was neutral, and his face remained expressionless.
"I hope you gentlemen will excuse me now," he said. "I have some matters that need my attention."
He bowed curtly, turned, and left them.
"Oh, he's a gold mine of information, isn't he?" Silk noted dryly. "Most Melusines love to gossip, but you've got to pry every word out of this one."
"Melusine?" Geryon said. "I didn't know that." Silk nodded.
"Ataska's a Melusine name. Kalzikath has some peculiar ideas about the aristocracy of talent. Angarak officers don't like the idea, but there's not too much they can do about it, if they want to keep their heads."
Geryon was not really that curious about the intricacies of Malorian politics, so he let the matter drop, to return to the subject that had been being discussed previously.
"I'm not quite clear about what you were saying, Grandfather. About our going to Rakhaga, I mean?"
"Saradas believes that she has a choice to make," the old man replied. "And there are certain conditions that have to be met before she can make it. I have got a suspicion that your meeting with Zakath might be one of those conditions."
"You don't actually believe her, do you?"
"I have seen stranger things happen, and I always walk very softly around the seers of Kel."
"I haven't seen anything about a meeting of that kind in the Mrin Codex."
"Neither have I. But there are more things in the world than the Mrin Codex. You've got to keep in mind the fact that Saradas is drawing on the prophecies of both sides, And if the prophecies are equal, they have equal truth. Not only that, Serratus is probably drawing on some prophecies that only the seers know about. Wherever this list of preconditions came from, though, I'm fairly certain that she won't let us get to this place, which is no more, until every item has been crossed off of her list.
Won't let us? Silk said.
Do not underestimate Serratus, Silk, Belgarath cautioned. She is the receptacle of all of the power of the Dalls, and that means that she can probably do things the rest of us could not even begin to dream of. Let us look at things from a practical point of view, though. When we started out, we were half a year behind Xandromos, and we were planning a very tedious and time-consuming trek across Tolmurgos. But we kept getting interrupted.
Oh, tell me about it, Silk said sardonically.
Isn't it curious that after all of those interruptions, we have reached the eastern side of the continent ahead of schedule, and have cut Xandromos's lead down to a few weeks?
Silk blinked, then his eyes narrowed. Yes. Gives you something to think about, doesn't it?
The old man pulled his cloak more tightly about him. He looked again around at the settling snow.
Let's go inside, he suggested. It is really unpleasant out here.
The coast of Haga was backed by low hills, filmy-looking and white in the thick snowfall. There were extensive salt marshes at the water's edge, and the brown reeds bent under their burden of wet, clinging snow. A black-looking wooden pier extended out across the marshes to deeper water, and they disembarked from the Malorian ship without incident. At the landward end of the pier, a wagon track ran up into the hills, its twin ruts buried in snow. Tsadi, the eunuch, looked upward with a slightly bemused expression as they rode off of the pier and onto the road. He lightly brushed one long-fingered hand across his shaved scalp.
They feel like fairy wings, he smiled.
What's that? Selk asked him.
The snowflakes. I've almost never seen snow before. Only when I was visiting a northern kingdom. And I actually believe that this is the first time I have ever been out of doors when it was snowing. It's not too bad, is it?
Silk gave him a sour look.
The first chance I get, I'll buy you a sled.
Tsadi looked puzzled.
Excuse me, Keldar, but what is a sled?
Silk sighed.
Oh, never mind, Tsadi. I was only trying to be funny.
At the top of the first hill, a dozen or so crosses leaned at various angles beside the road. Hanging from each cross was a skeleton, with a few tattered rags clinging to its bleached bones, and a clump of snow crowning its vacant-eyed skull.
One is curious to know the reason for that, General Ataska,
Tsadi said mildly, pointing at the grim display at the roadside.
Bonacy, Excellency,
Ataska replied curtly.
His Imperial Majesty seeks to alienate the Murgos from their king. He hopes to make them realize that Urgot is the cause of their misfortunes.
Tsadi shook his head dubiously.
I would question the reasoning behind that particular policy, he disagreed. Atrocities seldom endear one to the victims. I have always preferred bribery myself.
Murgos are accustomed to being treated atrociously,
Ataska shrugged.
It is all they understand. Why haven't you taken them down and buried them?
Durnik demanded, his face pale and his voice thick with outrage. Ataska gave him a long, steady look.
Economy, goodman, he replied. An empty cross really does not prove very much. If we took them down, we would just have to replace them with fresh Murgos. That gets to be tedious after a while, and sooner or later, One starts to run out of people to crucify. Leaving the skeletons there proves our point, and it saves time.
Geryon did his best to keep his body between Zinedra and the gruesome object lessened at the side of the road, trying to shield her from that hideous sight. She rode on obliviously, however, her face strangely numb, and her eyes blank and unseeing. He threw a quick, questioning glance at Polgara, and saw a slight frown on her face. He dropped back and pulled his horse in beside hers.
"What's wrong with her?" he asked in a tense whisper. "I am not entirely sure, Geryon," she whispered back. "Is it the melancholia again?"
There was a sick, sinking feeling in the pit of his stomach.
"I don't think so."
Her eyes were narrowed in thought. She absently pulled the hood of her blue robe forward to cover the white lock in the midnight of her hair.
"I will keep an eye on her."
"Well, what can I do?"
"Stay with her. Try to get her to talk. She might say something to give us clues."
Zinedra, however, made few responses to Geryon's efforts to engage her in conversation, and her answers for the remainder of that snowy day quite frequently had little relevance to either his questions or his observations. As evening began to settle over the war-ravaged countryside of Haga, General Ateska called a halt, and his soldiers began to erect several scarlet pavilions in the lee of a fire-blackened stone wall, all that remained of a burned-out village.
"We should reach Rakhaga by late tomorrow afternoon," he advised them. "That large pavilion in the center of the encampment will be yours for the night. My men will bring you your evening meal in a little while. Now, if you will all excuse me..."
He inclined his head briefly, then turned his horse around to supervise his men. When the soldiers had completed the erection of the pavilions, Geryon and his friends dismounted in front of the one Ateska had indicated. Silk looked around at the guard detachment moving into position around the large red tent.
"I wish that he would make up his mind," he said irritably.
"I don't quite follow you, Prince Keldar,"
Velvet said to him.
"Just who should make up his mind?"
"Ateska. He is the very soul of courtesy. But he surrounds us with armed guards."
"The troops might just be there to protect us, Keldar," she pointed out. "This is a war zone, after all."
"Of course," he said dryly. "And cows might fly, too, if they had wings."
"What a fascinating observation," she marveled.
"Oh, I wish you wouldn't do that all of the time."
"Do what?"
Her brown eyes were wide and innocent.
"Oh, forget it."
The supper Ateska's cooks prepared for them was plain, consisting of soldiers' rations and served on 10 plates, but it was hot and filling. The interior of the pavilion was heated by charcoal braziers and filled with the golden glow of hanging oil lamps. The furnishings were of a military nature, the kinds of tables and beds and chairs that could be assembled and disassembled rapidly, and the floors and walls were covered with Malorian carpets dyed a solid red color. Eriand looked around curiously after he had pushed his plate back.
"They seem awfully partial to red, don't they?"
"I think it reminds them of blood," Durnik declared bleakly. "They like blood."
He turned to look coldly at the mute Toth.
"Well, if you've finished eating, I think we'd prefer it if you left the table," he said in a flat tone.
"That is hardly polite, Durnik,"
Polgara said reprovingly.
"I wasn't trying to be polite, Paul. I don't see why he has to be put in with us in the first place. He's a traitor. Why doesn't he go stay with his friends?"
The giant mute rose from the table, his face melancholy. He lifted one hand, as if he were about to make one of those obscure gestures with which he and the smith communicated. But Durnik deliberately turned his back on him. Toth sighed and went over to sit unobtrusively in one corner.
"Geryon?"
Zinedra said suddenly, looking around with a worried little frown.
"Where's my baby?"
He stared at her.
"Where's Geryon?"
she demanded, her voice shrill.
Zinedra, he started.
I hear him crying. What have you done with him?
She suddenly sprang to her feet and began to dash about the tent, flinging back the curtains that partitioned off the sleeping quarters, yanking back the blankets on each bed.
Help me,
she cried to them.
Help me find my baby.
Geryon crossed the tent quickly to take her by the arm.
Zinedra?
No,
she shouted at him.
You have hidden him somewhere. Let me go.
She wrenched herself free of his grasp and began overturning the furniture in her desperate search, sobbing and moaning unintelligibly. Again Geryon tried to restrain her, but she suddenly hissed at him and extended her fingers like talons to claw at his eyes.
Zinedra, stop that!
But she darted around him and bolted out of the pavilion into the snowy night. As Geryon burst through the tent flap in pursuit, he found his way barred by a red-cloaked Malorian soldier.
You'll get back inside,
the man barked, blocking Geryon with a shaft of his spear. Over the guard's shoulder, Geryon saw Zinedra struggling with another soldier. Without even thinking, he smashed his fist into the face in front of him. The guard reeled backward and fell. Geryon leaped over him, but found himself suddenly seized from behind by a half-dozen more men.
"Leave her alone!"
he shouted at the guard, who was cruelly holding one of the little queen's arms behind her.
"Get back outside the tent!"
a rough voice barked, and Geryon found himself being dragged backward step by step toward the tent flap. The soldier holding Zinedra was half-lifting, half-pushing her back toward the same place. With a tremendous effort, Geryon got control of himself and coldly began to draw in his will.
"That will be enough!"
Polgara's voice cracked from the doorway to the tent. The soldiers stopped, looking uncertainly at each other and somewhat fearfully at the commanding presence in the doorway.
"Durnik,"
she said then, "help Geryon bring Zinedra back inside." Geryon shook himself free of the restraining hands, and he and Durnik took the violently struggling little queen from the soldier, pulling her back toward the pavilion.
"Sadi,"
Bulgara said as Durnik and Geryon entered the tent, with Zinedra between them.
"Do you have any Oret in that case of yours?"
"Certainly, Lady Polgara," the eunuch replied. "But are you sure that Oret is appropriate here? I would be more inclined toward Naladium, personally."
"I think we have got more than a case of simple hysteria on our hands, Sadi. I want something strong enough to ensure that she does not wake up the minute my back is turned."
"Whatever you think is best, Lady Polgara."
He crossed the carpeted floor, opened his red leather case, and took out a vial of dark blue liquid. Then he went to the table and picked up a cup of water. He looked at her inquiringly. She frowned.
Make it 3 drops, she decided.
He gave her a slightly startled look, then gravely measured out the dosage. It took several moments of combined effort to get Zinedra to drink the contents of the cup. She continued to sob and struggle for several moments. But then her struggles grew gradually weaker, and her sobbing lessened. Finally, she closed her eyes with a deep sigh, and her breathing became regular.
"Let's get her to bed,"
Bulgara said, leading the way to one of the curtained-off sleeping chambers. Geryon picked up the tiny form of his sleeping wife and followed.
"What's wrong with her, Aunt Paul?"
he demanded, as he laid her gently on the bed.
"I'm not positive,"
Polgara replied, covering Zinedra with a rough soldier's blanket.
"I will need more time to pin it down."
"What can we do?"
"Not very much while we are on the road," she admitted candidly. "We'll keep her asleep until we get to Rakhaga. Once I get her into a more stable situation, I will be able to work on it. Stay with her. I want to talk with Sadi for a few moments."
Geryon sat worriedly by the bed, gently holding his wife's limp little hand while Polgara went back out to consult with the eunuch concerning the various drugs in his case. Then she returned, drawing the drape shut behind her.
"He has most of what I need," she reported quietly. "I will be able to improvise the rest."
She touched Geryon's shoulder and bent forward.
"General Ateska just came in," she whispered to him. "He wants to see you.
I would not be too specific about the cause of Senedra's attack. We cannot be sure just how much Sakath knows about our reasons for being here, and Ateska's certain to report everything that happens. So watch what you say. He started to protest. You cannot do anything here, Garion, and they need you out there. I'll watch her.
Is she subject to the seizures often?
Ateska was asking, as Garion came through the draped doorway.
She's very high-strung,
Silk replied. Sometimes circumstances get the best of her. Polgara knows what to do. Ateska turned to face Garion.
Your Majesty, he said in a chilly tone, I don't appreciate your attacking my soldiers.
He got in my way, General, Garion replied. I don't think I hurt him all that much.
There is a principle involved, Your Majesty.
Yes, Garion agreed. There is. Give the man my apologies, but advise him not to interfere with me again, particularly when it concerns my wife. I do not really like hurting people, but I can make exceptions when I have to. Ateska's look grew steely, and the gaze Garion returned was just as bleak. They stared at each other for a long moment.
With all due respect, Your Majesty, Ateska said finally, don't abuse my hospitality again.
Only if the situation requires it, General.
I will instruct my men to prepare a litter for your wife, Ateska said then, and let us plan to get an early start tomorrow. If the Queen is ill, we want to get her to Rakhaga as soon as possible.
Thank you, General, Garion replied. Ateska bowed coldly, then turned and left.
Wouldn't you say that was a trifle blunt, Belgarion?
Sadi murmured.
We are in Ateska's power at the moment,
Garion grunted. I didn't like his attitude. He looked at Belgarath, whose expression was faintly disapproving. Well, he asked.
I didn't say anything.
You didn't have to. I could hear you thinking all the way over here.
Well, then I don't have to say it, do I?
The next day dawned cold and raw, but the snow had stopped. Garion rode at the side of Zinedra's horse-borne litter with his face mirroring his concern. The road they followed ran northwesterly past more burned-out villages and shattered towns. The ruins were covered with a thick coating of the clinging wet snow that had fallen the previous day, and each of them was encircled by a ring of those grim, occupied crosses and stakes. It was about mid-afternoon when they crested a hill and saw the lead-gray expanse of Lake Haga stretching far to the north and east. On the near shore was a large walled city.
Rakhaga,
Ateska said with a certain relief. They rode on down the hill toward the city. A brisk wind was blowing in off of the lake, whipping their cloaks about them and tossing the manes of their horses.
All right, gentlemen, Ateska said over his shoulder to his troops. Let's form up and try to look like soldiers.
The red-cloaked Malorians pulled their horses into a double file and straightened in their saddles. The walls of Rakhaga had been breached in several places, and the tops of the battlements were chipped and pitted from the storms of steel-tipped arrows that had swept over them. The heavy gates had been burst asunder during the final assault on the city, and hung in splinters from their rusty iron hinges. The guards at the gate drew themselves up and saluted smartly as Ateska led the way into the city. The battered condition of the stone houses within the walls attested to the savagery of the fighting, which had ensued when Rakhaga had fallen. Many of them stood unroofed to the sky, their gaping soot-blackened windows staring out at the rubble-choked streets. A work-gang of sullen Murgos dragging clanking chains behind them labored to clear the fallen building stones out of the slushy streets under the watchful eyes of a detachment of Malorian soldiers.
You know, Silk said, that's the first time I've ever seen a Murgo actually work. I didn't think they even knew how.
The headquarters of the Malorian army in Tol Murgos was in a large, imposing yellow brick house near the center of the city. It faced a broad, snowy square, and a marble staircase led up to the main door, with a file of red-cloaked Malorian soldiers lining each side.
"The former residence of the Mergo military governor of Haga," Sadi noted, as they drew near the house.
"Oh, you've been here before, then?" Silk asked.
"In my youth," Sadi replied. "Rakaga has always been the center of the slave trade."
Ateska dismounted and turned to one of his officers.
"Captain," he said, "have your men bring the queen's litter. Tell them to be very careful."
As the rest of them swung down from their mounts, the captain's men unfastened the litter from the saddles of the two horses that had carried it, and started up the marble stairs in General Ateska's wake. Just inside the broad doors stood a polished table, and seated behind it was an arrogant-looking man with angular eyes and an expensive-looking scarlet uniform. Against the far wall stood a row of chairs occupied by bored-looking officials.
"State your business,"
the officer behind the table said brusquely. Ateska's face did not change expression as he silently stared at the officer.
"I said, to state your business."
"Have the rules changed, Colonel?"
Ateska asked in a deceptively mild voice.
"Do we no longer rise in the presence of a superior?"
"I am too busy to jump to my feet for every petty Malsine official from the outlying districts," the colonel declared.
"Captain," Ateska said flatly to his officer, "if the colonel is not on his feet in the space of two heartbeats, would you be so kind as to cut off his head for me?"
"Yes, sir," the captain replied, drawing his sword even as the startled colonel jumped to his feet.
"Much better," Ateska told him. "Now, let's begin over again. Do you by chance remember how to salute?"
The colonel saluted smartly, though his face was pale.
"Splendid. We will make a soldier of you yet. Now, one of the people I was escorting, a lady of high station, fell ill during our journey. I want a warm, comfortable room prepared for her immediately."
"Sir,"
the colonel protested, "I am not authorized to do that."
"Don't put your sword away just yet, Captain."
"But, General, the members of His Majesty's household staff make all of those decisions. They will be infuriated if I overstep my bounds."
"I will explain it to His Majesty, Colonel," Ateska told him. "The circumstances are a trifle unusual, but I am sure that he will approve."
The colonel faltered, his eyes filled with indecision.
"Do it, Colonel. Now." "I'll see to it at once, General,"
the colonel replied, snapping to attention.
"You men,"
he said to the soldiers holding Zinedra's litter,
"follow me."
Geryon automatically started to follow the litter, but Polgara took his arm firmly.
"No, Geryon. I will go with her. There is nothing you can do right now, and I think Sakath is going to want to talk to you. Just be careful of what you say."
And she went off down the hallway behind the litter.
"I see that Malorian society still has its little frictions," Silk said blandly to General Ateska.
"Angarax," Ateska grunted. "Sometimes they have a little difficulty coping with the modern world. Excuse me, Prince Keldar. I want to let His Majesty know that we are here."
He went to a polished door at the other end of the room and spoke briefly with one of the guards. Then he came back.
"The Emperor is being advised of our arrival. I expect that he will see us in a few moments."
A rather chubby, bald-headed man in a plain, though obviously costly, brown robe, and with a heavy gold chain about his neck, approached them.
"Ateska, my dear fellow," he greeted the general. "They told me that you were stationed at Rakvakat."
"I have some business with the Emperor, Braedor. What are you doing in Tol Mergos?"
"Cooling my heels," the chubby man replied. "I've been waiting for 2 days to see Kelzukath."
"Who is minding the shop at home?"
"I've arranged it so that it more or less runs itself," Braedor replied. "The report I have for His Majesty is so vital that I decided to carry it myself."
"What could be so earth-shaking that it would drag the chief of the Bureau of Internal Affairs away from the comforts of Mal Seth?"
"I believe that it's time for His Imperial Exaltedness
to tear himself away from his amusements here in Tol Mergos and come back to the capital. Careful, Bredor,
Ataska said with a brief smile.
Your fine-tuned Mersin prejudices are showing. Things are getting grim at home, Ataska,
Bredor said seriously.
I have got to talk with the Emperor. Can you help me to get into Shilim?
I will see what I can do.
Thank you, my friend,
Bredor said, clasping the general's arm.
The whole fate of the Empire may depend on my persuading Kalzakath to come back to Malzeth.
General Ateska,
one of the spear-armed guards at the polished door said in a loud voice,
His Imperial Majesty will see you and your prisoners now.
Very good,
Ateska replied, ignoring the ominous word, prisoners. He looked at Geryon.
The Emperor must be very eager to see you, Your Majesty, he noted. It often takes weeks to gain an audience with him. Shall we go inside?
Chapter 2 Kalzakath, the Emperor of Boundless Meloria, lounged in a red cushioned chair at the far end of a large plain room. The Emperor wore a simple white linen robe, severe and unadorned. Though Geryon knew that he was at least in his 40s, his hair was untouched by gray, and his face was unlined. His eyes, however, betrayed a kind of dead weariness, devoid of any joy or even any interest in life. Curled in his lap lay a common mackerel-striped alley cat, her eyes closed and her forepaws alternately kneading his thigh. Although the Emperor himself wore the simplest of clothes, the guards lining the walls all wore steel breastplates deeply inlaid with gold.
My Emperor, General Ateska said with a deep bow, I have the honor to present His Royal Majesty, King Bel Geryon of Riva.
Geryon nodded briefly, and Zakath inclined his head in response.
Our meeting is long overdue, Bel Geryon, he said in a voice as dead as his eyes. Your exploits have shaken the world.
Yours have also made a certain impression, Zakath?
Geryon had decided even before he had left Rakvakat that he would not perpetuate the absurdity of the Malorian's self-bestowed cow. A faint smile touched Zakath's lips.
Ha ha,
he said in a tone which indicated that he saw through Geryon's attempt to be subtle. He nodded briefly to the others, and his attention finally fixed itself upon the rumpled, untidy form of Geryon's grandfather.
And of course you, sir, would be Belgarath. I am a bit surprised to find you so ordinary-looking. The Grolems of Meloria all agree that you are 100 feet tall, possibly 200, and that you have horns and a forked tail.
I'm in disguise,
Belgarath replied with aplomb. Zakath chuckled, though there was little amusement in that almost mechanical sound. Then he looked around with a faint frown.
I seem to note some absences.
Queen Zenedra fell ill during the journey, Your Majesty,
Ateska advised him.
Lady Pogra is attending to her. Ill? Is it serious?
It is difficult to say at this point, Your Imperial Majesty,
Tsari replied unctuously.
But we have given her certain medications, and I have every confidence in Lady Pulgara's skill.
Zakath looked at Geryon.
You should have sent word on ahead, Belgeryon. I have a healer on my personal staff. A Talesian woman with remarkable gifts. I will send her to the Queen's chamber at once. Our first concern must be your wife's health.
Thank you,
Geryon replied with genuine gratitude. Zakath touched a bell pull and spoke briefly with the servant, who responded immediately to his summons.
Please, the Emperor said then, seat yourselves. I have no particular interest in ceremony.
As the guards hastily brought chairs for them,
The cat, sleeping on Zakath's lap, half opened her golden eyes and looked around at them. She rose to her paws, arched her back, and yawned. Then she jumped heavily to the floor with an audible grunt, and waddled over to sniff at Arion's fingers. With a faintly amused look, Zakath watched his obviously pregnant cat make her matronly way across the carpet.
"You will note that my cat has been unfaithful to me again."
He sighed in mock resignation.
"It happens fairly frequently, I am afraid, and she never seems to feel the slightest guilt about it."
The cat jumped up into Arion's lap, nestled down, and began to purr contentedly.
"You have grown, boy," Zakath said to the young man. "Have they taught you how to talk as yet?"
"I've picked up a few words, Zakath," Arion said in his clear voice.
"I know the rest of you by reputation, at least," Zakath said then. "Goodman Durnik and I met on the plains of Mishrak Achtol. And, of course, I have heard of the Magraven Lissel of Drasnian Intelligence, and of Prince Keldar, who strives to become the richest man in the world."
Velvet's graceful curtsy of acknowledgement was not quite so florid as Silk's grandiose bow.
"And here, of course," the Emperor continued, "is Sadi, chief eunuch in the palace of Queen Zamisra."
Sadi bowed with a fluid grace.
"I must say your majesty is remarkably well informed," he said in his contralto voice. "You have read us all like an open book." "My chief of intelligence tries to keep me informed, Sadi. He may not be as gifted as the inestimable Javelin of Boktor, but he knows about most of what is going on in this part of the world. He has mentioned that huge fellow over in the corner, but so far he has not been able to discover his name."
"He's called Toth," Arion supplied. "He's a mute, so we have to do his talking for him."
"And a Dalesian besides," Zakath noted. "A very curious circumstance."
Geryon had been closely watching this man. Beneath the polished, urbane exterior, he sensed a kind of subtle probing. The idle greetings, which seemed to be no more than a polite means of putting them at their ease, had a deeper motive behind them. In some obscure way, he sensed that Zakath was somehow testing each of them. The Emperor straightened then.
"You have an oddly assorted company with you, Belgarian. And you are a long way from home. I am curious about your reasons for being here in Tol Murgos."
"I'm afraid that's a private matter, Zakath."
One of the Emperor's eyebrows rose slightly.
"Under the circumstances, that is hardly a satisfactory answer, Belgarian. I cannot really take the chance that you're allied with Urgot."
"Would you accept my word that I am not?"
"Not until I know a bit more about your visit to Rakoga. Urgot left there quite suddenly, apparently in your company, and reappeared just as suddenly on the plains of Morth, where he and a young woman led his troops out of an ambush I had gone to a great deal of trouble to arrange. You will have to admit, that is a peculiar set of circumstances."
"Not when you look at it from a practical standpoint," Belgaroth said. "The decision to take Urgot with us was mine. He'd found out who we are, and I did not want an army of Murgos on our heels. Murgos are not too bright, but they can be an inconvenience at times."
Zakath looked surprised.
"He was your prisoner?"
Belgaroth shrugged.
"In a manner of speaking."
The Emperor laughed rather wryly.
"You could have wrung almost any concession from me if you had just delivered him into my hands, you know. Why did you let him go?"
"We didn't need him any more," Geryon replied. "We had reached the shores of Lake Thaha, so he really wasn't any kind of threat to us."
Sakath's expression narrowed slightly.
A few other things happened as well, I think, he observed. Urgot has always been a notorious coward, wholly under the domination of the Grolum Akachak and of his father's generals. But he did not seem very timid while he was extricating his troops from the trap I had laid for them, and all of the reports filtering out of Rak Urga seem to suggest that he is actually behaving like a king. Did you, by any chance, have anything to do with that?
It's possible, I suppose, Garion answered. Urgot and I talked a few times, and I told him what he was doing wrong.
Sakath tapped one forefinger against his chin, and his eyes were shrewd.
You may not have made a lion out of him, Belgarion, but at least he is no longer a rabbit.
A chill smile touched the Malorian's lips.
In a way, I am rather glad about that. I have never taken much satisfaction in hunting rabbits.
He shaded his eyes with one hand, although the light in the room was not particularly bright.
But what I cannot understand is how you managed to spirit him out of the Drojum Palace and away from the city. He has whole regiments of bodyguards.
You're overlooking something, Sakath, Belgoroth said to him. We have certain advantages that are not available to others.
Sorcery, you mean? Is it really all that reliable?
I've had some luck with it from time to time. Sakath's eyes had become suddenly intent.
They tell me that you are 5,000 years old, Belgoroth. Is that true?
7, actually. Or a little more. Why do you ask?
In all of those years, has it not ever occurred to you simply to seize power? You could have made yourself king of the world, you know.
Belgarath looked amused.
Why would I want to? All men want power. It is human nature.
Has all your power really made you happy?
It has certain satisfactions. Enough to make up for all of the petty distractions that go with it. I can endure those. At least I am in a position where no one tells me what to do.
No one tells me what to do either, and I am not saddled with all of those tedious responsibilities. Belgarath straightened.
All right, Sakath. Shall we get to the point? What are your intentions concerning us? I have not really decided that yet.
The Emperor looked around at them.
I presume that we can all be civilized about the present situation.
How do you mean, civilized?
I will accept your word that none of you will try to escape or do anything rash. I am aware that you and a number of your friends have certain specialized talents. I do not want to be forced to take steps to counteract them.
We have some rather pressing business, Garion replied carefully. So we can only delay for just so long. For the time being, however, I think we can agree to be reasonable about things.
Good. We'll have to talk later, you and I, and come to know one another. I have had comfortable quarters prepared for you and your friends, and I know that you are anxious about your wife. Now, I hope you will excuse me, but I have some of those tedious responsibilities that Belgorath mentioned to attend to.
Although the house was very large, it was not, strictly speaking, a palace. It appeared that the Murgo Governor's General of Haga, who had ordered it built, had not shared the grandiose delusions which afflicted the rulers of Urga, and so the building was more functional than ornate.
I hope you will excuse me,
General Ateska said to them when they had emerged from the audience chamber.
I am obliged to deliver a full report to His Majesty about various matters. Then I must return immediately to Rakvokat.
He looked at Geryon.
The circumstances under which we met were not the happiest, Your Majesty, he said. But I hope you won't think too unkindly of me.
He bowed rather stiffly, then left them in the care of a member of the Emperor's staff. The man who had led them down a long, dark paneled hallway toward the center of the house was obviously not an Angorak. He had not the angular eyes nor the stiff, bleak-faced arrogance that marked the men of that race. His cheerful, round face seemed to hint at a Melsine heritage, and Geryon remembered that the bureaucracy which controlled most aspects of Malorian life was made up almost exclusively of Melsines.
His Majesty asked me to assure you that your quarters are not intended to be a prison,
the official told them, as they approached a heavily barred iron door blocking off one portion of the hallway.
This was a Murgle house before we took the city, and it has certain structural peculiarities. Your rooms are in what once were the women's quarters, and Murgles are fanatically protective of their women. It has to do with their concept of racial purity, I think.
At that moment, Geryon had little interest in sleeping arrangements. All of his concern was for Tenedra. "Do you happen to know where I might find my wife?" he asked the moon-faced bureaucrat.
"There, at the end of this corridor, Your Majesty,"
the Melsine replied, pointing toward a blue-painted door at the far end of the hall.
"Thank you,"
Geryon glanced at the others. "I'll be back in a little while," he told them, and strode on ahead. The room he entered was warm, and the lighting subdued. Deep, ornately woven Malorian carpets covered the floor, and soft green velvet drapes covered the tall, narrow windows. Tenedra lay in a high-posted bed against the wall opposite the door, and Polgara was seated at the bedside, her expression grave.
"Has there been any change?"
Geryon asked her softly, closing the door behind him.
"Nothing as yet,"
she replied. Tenedra's face was pale as she slept, with her crimson curls tumbled on her pillow.
"She is going to be all right, isn't she?"
Geryon asked.
"Oh, I'm sure of it, Geryon."
Another woman sat near the bed. She wore a light green cowled robe, despite the fact that she was indoors. She had the hood pulled up, partially concealing her face. Tenedra muttered something in a strangely harsh tone and tossed her head restlessly on the pillow. The cowled woman frowned.
"Is this her customary voice, Lady Polgara?"
she asked.
Polgara looked at her sharply. "No," she replied. "As a matter of fact, it is not."
"Would the drug you gave her in some way affect the sound of her speech?"
"No, it wouldn't. Actually, she shouldn't be making any sound at all."
"Ah,"
the woman said.
"I think perhaps I understand now."
She leaned forward and very gently laid the fingertips of one hand on Tenedra's lips. She nodded then and withdrew her hand.
"As I suspected,"
she murmured. Polgara also reached out to touch Tenedra's face. Geryon heard the faint whisper of her will, and the candle at the bedside flared up slightly, then sank back until its flame was scarcely more than a pinpoint.
"Oh, I should have guessed,"
Polgara accused herself.
"What is it?"
Geryon asked in alarm.
"Another mind is seeking to dominate your wife, and to subdue her will, Your Majesty,"
the cowled woman told him.
"It is an art sometimes practiced by the Grolems. They discovered it quite by accident during the Third Age."
"This is Andel, Geryon,"
Polgara told him.
"Sakath sent her here to help care for Tenedra."
Geryon nodded briefly to the hooded woman.
"Exactly what do we mean by the word dominate?"
"You should be more familiar with that than most people, Geryon. I am sure you remember Asherak the Murgo."
Geryon felt a sudden chill, remembering the force of the mind that had from his earliest childhood sought that same control over his awareness.
"Drive it out," he pleaded. "Get whomever it is out of her mind."
"Perhaps not quite yet, Geryon," Polgara said coldly. "We have an opportunity here. Let's not waste it."